I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, Israel's war on the Gaza Strip is in its 23rd day. The Tel Aviv regime pounding the besieged territory from ground, sea, and air as fighting is ongoing between resistance groups and regime forces. Israel has hit areas around the El Quds Hospital, which shelters around 14,000 people. Palestinian Red Crescent says it's received serious threats to immediately evacuate the hospital. Israel had said that its ground troops are fighting inside Gaza. The Qassam Brigade said that Israeli forces are trying to enter from east of Rafah or forced to draw back from the besieged territory. The military wing of Hamas also announced destroying two Israeli tanks in northern Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinians living in the besieged territory are facing a dire humanitarian situation but refuse to leave their homes.
We will stay here whether Israeli forces come in by land or by airstrikes. Whatever happens, we will be steadfast. We will not make the same mistakes we made in 1948 when they displaced us from our homes. Until the last moment, we will remain here. This is our land and we will not leave. Any day now, we're going to go back and live upon the ruins of our homes.
We cannot handle anymore. Even mountains wouldn't bear what we're going through. We reached a state where we wish to have died under the rubble just to find some rest. Our life is torture. We wait in line for 3 hours to use the toilets.
As you see, this is what happened. This is not just shelling, but an earthquake. Honestly, it's like an earthquake. I do not know what to say. May God take revenge from them. But despite this destruction, pain, martyrs, injuries, we are a nation that does not kneel but to God.
Now, Palestinians in Gaza are reportedly using seawater to survive. Health ministers are urging the international community to pressure Israel into halting attacks on health and infrastructure. The ministry says hospital operations have severely been hampered by the presence of thousands of displaced people sheltering there. More than 8,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's relentless bombardment of Gaza that began on October 7th. 70% of the casualties are women, children, and the elderly. The Iranian president says the defeat Israel suffered in the ground invasion of Gaza was even heavier than the one inflicted on it during Operation Al-Aqsa flood. In an interview, Ibrahim Raisi said that Israel claimed it was surprised by the operation on October 7th, but it was armed to the teeth when it invaded Gaza and was forced to pull out. He said the victory for the Palestinian nation also came despite the U.S. and several European countries providing military and financial support for Tel Aviv. Raisi added that Operation Al-Aqsa flood was the result of 75 years of Palestinian anger building up over the Israeli occupation, crimes, and desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque. He stressed that Iran supports and approves of the actions of resistance forces across the region, but they're independent in their decision-making and actions. The president said that the U.S. and Israel cannot eliminate the resistant movement because resistance is not limited to one particular person or group. It's in the blood of Palestinians. Meantime, pro-Palestine rallies have been held across the globe to demand an end to the Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
For a ceasefire. This has been going on for 75 years now. It's time for Israel to stop oppressing the Palestinian people. You've seen the deaths. The death toll has risen. What are we? Nearly at 8,000 people now. Most of the civilians there are children and minors. The Western government is doing absolutely nothing. You know, these superpowers at play are not doing enough at the moment. This is why we're here.
in the Australian city of Sydney and in New York. In the U.S., rallyers chanted anti-Israel slogans, condemning the regime's brutalities against the people in Gaza. Also, tens of thousands marched through the streets of the British capital, London, to call for a stop to Israeli carnage. In Turkey's city of Istanbul, hundreds of thousands held rallies to condemn Tel Aviv's onslaught. They also urged President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to cut off diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. Several other cities across the world, including in the occupied West Bank, were the scenes of similar events.
For the third Saturday in a row, pro-Palestine demonstrators packing the streets of central London to condemn the UK government's unequivocal support for Israel.
Our government is cheering this on and it's supporting Israel to carry on with the massacre in Gaza. So we want to try and stop that.
I'm so ashamed of our government that they are sanctioning what I think is just collective murder. And it really, really has got to stop. It's awful.
They should be listening to the protesters and demanding that there's an immediate and complete ceasefire, that humanitarian aid is allowed through.
From Madrid to Milan and beyond, even in Germany, home to one of the largest Muslim communities in the EU, where such protests have been restricted over what was described as anti-Semitism concerns.
Despite government attempts to delegitimize it, support for Palestinians is on the rise, with hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets of central London today to raise awareness of what's happening in Gaza and to express solidarity with the Palestinians.
Public pressure seems to be working. London's Labour mayor has become the latest politician to call for a ceasefire, breaking ranks with his party's leader, Keir Starmer, who said Israel reserved the right to cut all supplies to Gaza. 250 high-ranking lawyers have written an open letter to the government urging it to stop arming Israel.
And they are paying the taxes to kill our brothers, so it's unfair. It's completely unfair.
It should stop. We want ceasefire. We want talking, negotiating, but giving Palestine what it deserves, having been bullied for 50, 60, 70 years.
As the war on Gaza rages on, there is no sign of the emotions letting up or the demands that so many here are making for their leaders to find a political solution to the crisis. Saeed Pourreza, London.
All right, now let's continue with our special coverage on Palestine. Let me, from Khan Yunis, bring in our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon. Ashraf, we have this reports of Israeli forces hitting the areas near Al-Quds Hospital, and there are lots of people taking shelter there, and the hospital itself also reportedly received threats, with the Red Crescent there actually getting this strongly worded note of threat to evacuate the hospitals. And you were telling me that even the few remaining hospitals that are operating, they're already facing lots of problems.
Well, Bahrouz, I know the Al-Quds Hospital, also known the Red Crescent Society, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society Hospital in the Tal Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City, is one of my children was born there. So I know that place very well. I know almost every crook and cranny in that place. It's a big building. It's like an apartment building. It's one of the biggest, probably is the biggest hospital in Palestine, not in Gaza, not in the Gaza Strip. It's the biggest hospital in Palestine, and one that has most advanced diagnosis machines in the Gaza Strip. Now that place currently has at least 12,000 IDPs, internally displaced persons. In addition to, I believe, 400 patients, including injured people from this war and from previous Israeli aggressions who continue to be treated inside Al-Quds Hospital. For over a week now, Israel has been threatening Al-Quds Hospital, in addition to other hospitals like Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, Al-Auda Hospital in northern Gaza. And as we all know, they already bombed the Al-Ahli Al-Arabi Hospital, also known as the Protestant Church Hospital, and killed hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. So it's not the first time that Israel attacks hospitals in the Gaza Strip. Since 2008, hospitals were attacked by Israeli regime forces. I remember back in 2008, covering the 22-day war, I remember an Apache helicopter firing a tow missile into the entrance of the emergency room, and I saw that with my own eyes. Shifa Hospital emergency room was hit. And I've seen hospitals in Beit Hanun directly hit by Israeli attacks. I saw Al-Wafa Hospital for Rehabilitation and for the treatment of elderly people being completely destroyed east of Shijaiya neighborhood back in 2014. So it would not be a surprise if Israel does blow up the Al-Quds Hospital with its inhabitants if they remain there, because they're very serious about this. They've already bombed the areas in the proximity of Al-Quds Hospital, and they also bombed very close to Al-Shifa Hospital as well. So the attacks tonight or tomorrow, the latest, are going to be against Al-Quds Hospital in Tel Hawa neighborhood, and Shifa Hospital, the central hospital in the Gaza Strip, where we used to do our coverage right. In the first 3 days of this war.
That's right. Ashraf, so where should people go then? I mean, when those major hospitals, and there are just a few of them, as you said, maybe a handful of them, as far as we know. We have Shifa, we have Al-Quds Hospital. So where else could they go? I mean, what should the people do then?
The only place left for anyone in Gaza to run to is to run to the sea and swim away. That's the only option they have, you know. Get a skiff, get a boat, or run away. Honestly, it is funny in a sarcastic way, because they're being crazy. Imagine, like, Tal al-Hawa neighborhood is close to Al-Azhar University in Gaza, close to the Islamic University in Gaza, close to the headquarters of the Palestinian Broadcasting Corporation in Gaza. And tens of thousands of people live in that neighborhood. Some of them live in private homes, but most of them live in apartment buildings. And the apartment buildings have already been damaged almost beyond recognition. So let's assume, I'm not going to say 14,000. Assume there is 1,000 people there, and they're not sick, and they're not wounded, and they want to leave Al-Quds Hospital right now. How in the world are they going to do it? If they're going to walk, there is no place safe in Gaza to walk. There is no streets to walk on. You have to walk on rubble to get away from Tal al-Hawa. After leaving Tal al-Hawa, you have to go, for example, to either Saladin Road, trying to make your way to the Gaza Wadi, or southwest towards the coastal road, heading also towards the Gaza Wadi. And for example, on a good day, I remember when I was a kid, I used to walk that distance. For a young man to walk in a normal circumstances, it will take you a few hours to reach the Gaza Wadi or the Gaza Valley. So can you imagine in this darkness, having sick people, young people, babies, children, infants, newborn babies, that they have to scramble through the rubble and in the darkness? Where do they go? They're dead anyway. Literally, unfortunately. Those people inside that building are dead anyway. They either leave or stay. They're going to die if Israel continues this.
That's terrible. Yeah, hopefully Israel will not be too serious and will spare that hospital. Thank you so much for that live coverage. Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Khan Yunis, Gaza. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
$39 million U.S. properties could face higher insurance costs from climate risks. Major insurance companies have already pulled out of states with high wildfire risks like California, Florida, and Louisiana. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Greece wrote, from California to Florida, homeowners have been facing a new climate reality. Insurance companies don't want to cover their properties. According to a new report released recently, the problem will only get worse. The nonprofit climate research firm First Street Foundation found that while about 6.8 million properties nationwide already rely on expensive public insurance programs, that's only a fraction of 39 million across the country that face similar conditions. Jeremy Porter, the head of climate implications at First Street and a contributor to the report, said, "There is this climate insurance bubble out there, and you can quantify it. Each state regulates its insurance market, and some limit how much companies can raise rates in a given year. In California, for example, anything more than a 7% hike requires a public hearing. According to First Street, such policies have meant premiums don't always accurately reflect risk, especially as climate change exacerbates natural disasters. This has led companies such as Allstate, State Farm, Nationwide, and others to pull out of areas with a high threat of wildfire, floods, and storms. In the Southern California city of San Bernardino, for example, non-renewals jumped 774% between 2015 and 2021. When that happens, homeowners often must enroll in a government-run insurance of last resort program where premiums can cost thousands of dollars more per year. David Russell, a professor of insurance and finance at California State University, Northridge, said, "The report shows that, actually, sound pricing is going to make it unaffordable to live in certain places as climate impacts emerge." He did not contribute to the report, but he said, "It's startling and it's a very well-documented report." Russell says that what's most likely to shock people is the economic toll on affected properties. When insurance costs soar, First Street shows, it severely undermines home values and in some cases erodes them entirely. The report found that insurance for the average California home could nearly quadruple if future risk is factored in, with those extra costs causing a roughly 39% drop in value. The situation is even worse in Florida and Louisiana, where flood insurance in Plaquemines Parish near New Orleans could go from $824 annually to $11,296, and a property could effectively become worthless. reporter said there is no education to the public of what's going on and where the risk is, explaining that most insurance models are proprietary. Even the Federal Emergency Management Agency doesn't make its flood insurance pricing available to the public. Homeowners must go through insurance brokers for a quote. First Street is posting its report online, and it also runs Risk Factor, where anyone can type in an address and receive user-friendly risk information for any property in the United States. One metric the site provides is annualized damage for flood and wind risk. Porter said that if that number is higher than a homeowner's current premiums, then a climate risk of some kind properly hasn't yet been priced into the coverage, he said. This would indicate that at some point this risk will get priced into their insurance costs, and their cost of homeownership would increase along with that. Wildfires are the fastest growing natural disaster risk, First Street reported. Over the next 30 years, it estimates the number of acres burnt will balloon from about 4 million acres per year to 9 million, and the number of structures destroyed is on track to double to 34,000 annually. Wildfires are also the predominant threat for 4.4 million of the 39 million properties that First Street identified as at risk of insurance upheaval. He said, "You don't want someone to live in a place that always burns. They don't belong there. We are subsidizing people to live in harm's way." First Street hopes that highlighting the climate insurance bubble allows people to make better informed decisions. For homeowners, that may mean taking precautions against, say, wildfires by replacing their roof or clearing flammable material from around their house. Policymakers, he said, would use the information to help at-risk communities adapt or to mitigate the risk. In either case, Porter said, reducing threats could help keep insurance rates from spiking. Ultimately, though, Russell says moving people out of disaster-prone areas will likely be necessary. He said, large numbers of people will need to be relocated away from areas that will be uninsurable. There is a reckoning on the horizon, and it's not pretty. Also, Bloomberg reported home insurance costs that have soared in much of the United States may get even higher. Tens of millions of properties around the U.S. are insured at prices that haven't caught up with the danger of hurricanes, wildfires, and floods, according to a new report from the First Street Foundation, a nonprofit that works to define and communicate risks posed by climate change. First Street estimates that 39 million U.S. homes are insured at artificially suppressed prices compared with the risk they actually face. Of those, nearly 6.8 million homes are covered by a state-backed insurer of last resort policies. At the core of the problem is an increase in the severity of disasters exacerbated by climate change and the damage they wreak. Take wildfires. Despite huge increases in federal government spending to contain breakouts, the U.S. acreage burned has gone up steadily, and the average number of structures destroyed by these blazes each year since 2009 has more than tripled to over 17,000. Wildfire risk is particularly bad in California, but insurance prices there are heavily regulated. So if a home that had a premium of $2,000 in 2010 saw it go up 7% a year, the most allowed under state law without a public hearing, the owners would have paid about $4,820 by 2022. But that is about $3,000 less than what would be sound. That explains in part why major insurers like State Farm, General Insurance Corporation, and Allstate Corporation are reducing their exposure to the state by not issuing new policies and in some cases declining to renew existing ones.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil fa. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, as you were previously with us in our series of discussions, we were trying to have a look at the different objectives of supplications in educating people. We said that school of supplication has a plethora of features in which sublime intentions are set by the legislators, by the Almighty Allah and the Ahlul Bayt. We said that the first objective, the most significant feature, is in the field of education. And it is the fact that in all supplications, we do not find the case where something is referred to non-God or non-divine thing. For example, in all these supplications, the absolute cause is God and nothing can ever take place without His consent. So, regarding this issue, Allama Tabatabai distinguishes between the Shi'i Gnosticism and the common Gnosticism. And he says that in the verses, traditions and supplications, we find a kind of a special system which paves the way for the Gnostic and the believer. So, in the behaviors and manners of all these great men of virtues in the school of the infallible imams, we may not see anything against the common sense and the rational thinking. Great men such as Sayyid ibn Tawus, Sayyid Bahrul Ulum, Ibn Fahd Hilli and others, all their great teachers, whose manners and behaviors have been based on the basis of those of the infallible Imams, alayhimus salam, are good exemplars. All these men are among the elite scholars of the employment of the verses of the Holy Quran, traditions, and commands of the school of the infallible Imams. So, in order to depict this significant feature of the infallible Imams, we will refer to some supplications And of course, we will only refer to the parts that are mostly crucially needed for our argumentation.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javob onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti ob onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ob kamju tishnagi ovar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ovaz balo vakas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So in order to prove that a most significant feature in the sphere of education is this monotheism, in this shape that we see in these supplications, the absolute cause is God, and nothing can ever take place without His consent. In Simat supplication, we see that God's name appears in the opening passage. Allahumma, inni as'aluka bismika al-azim al-a'zam. O Allah, I invoke you with your great name, which is greater than your names. Al-ajalli al-akram. More glorious than your names, more beloved than them. الذي إذا دعيت به على مغالق أبواب السماء للفتح بالرحمة فتحت. I invoke you with this name, with which, if you are involved to open the locks of the gates of heaven, they will be opened with mercy. وإذا دعيت به على مغالق أبواب الأرض للفرج فرجت. And if you are invoked with it to open up the narrow gates of the earth, when with deliverance, they will be opened up. In also the very same supplication, we read, وَبِحِكْمَتِكَ الَّتِي خَلَقْتَ بِهَا الظُّلْمَ وَجَعَلْتَهَا لَيْلًا سَكَنًا. And with your wisdom, by which you have created darkness, you made it as calmness, and at night, and you created light, you made it as a day. خلقت بها النور وجعلته نهارا. خلقت بها الشمس. You created the sun. وخلقت بها القمر. You created the moon. وخلقت بها الكواكب. You created the planets. وجعلتها نجوما. You made them all stars. In the supplication of Jawshan al-Kabir, God is given 1,000 names, each name of which relates to one another of the creation. يَمَلَّهُ الْمُلْكُ وَالْكَمَالِ, for example. O God, I invoke you, who have the absolute domination and perfection. Ya Munshi as-sahab al-thiqal, you have created the heavy clouds. Ya Sani'a kulli masnu', you have created everything. Ya Khaliqa kulli makhluq, you have created every creature. Ya Raziqa kulli marzuq, you have provided everyone and everything with the means of subsistence. Ya Man kullu shay'in qa'imun bih, O you, the creator of the universe. Ya Musawwir, all these names and attributes of the Almighty Allah are connected to one aspect of creation. This means that one important, objective of the supplications is to teach us to recognize the Almighty Allah as the absolute cause. We'll have a look at some other instances in the next episodes. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With the fog of war descending once more as the Zionist regime's propaganda machine lurches into motion, fabricating myths to shield the truth following the bombing of Gaza hospitals, while Western leaders and media obediently amplify Israel's distortions, muddying reality. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Stay tuned now for the first part of this program. The Middle East Monitor has covered this story and tells us more. The Zionist regime has been openly pre-justifying the recent hospital bombing and school bombing in the Gaza Strip. It's been pre-justifying war crimes, declaring with no fear of accountability that it will impose collective punishment by denying the residents of Gaza electricity, water and food. The Zionist regime's denial is not credible because the occupation regime has a long history of committing atrocities and massacres against innocent Palestinians. For decades, the brutal realities of massacres were suppressed and their details buried. But slowly, they came to light. Stories of indiscriminate slaughter, rape, torture and exile of defenseless civilians. The brutal details of these killings have been revealed over the course of time. Fortunately, in the world's social media, lies and propaganda are harder to conceal. While the Zionist regime still tries desperately to control the narrative, Palestinian voices now ring out louder. Their stories and images expose Israeli lies in real time. A cursory glance at history shows how mass killing of Palestinians was a strategy employed by the Zionist military to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. Israel's potential ground offensive in Gaza raises a chilling prospect. The prospect of mass slaughter and ethnic cleansing, repeating the dark tactics of the past. One of the earliest and most notorious was the massacre at the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin, in 1948. Hundreds of people, including men, women and children, and the elderly, were killed. The aim of the atrocity was to sow terror and fear to force the Palestinians to flee their homes. Three quarters of the population fled because of the terror campaign unleashed by the Israelis. Just a month after Deir Yassin massacre, Israeli forces slaughtered up to 200 Palestinians in the coastal village of Tantura. It was part of a ruthless ethnic cleansing campaign, Plan Dalet, to seize territory for a future Jewish state. Tantura was one of 64 Palestinian villages lining the road between Tel Aviv and Haifa. Once thriving coastal communities, all of them were wiped off the map, except two. The inhabitants of these villages were expelled en masse, joining the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians ethnically cleansed from their ancestral homelands in 1948. Israel's seemingly never-ending drive to uproot Palestinians from their homes by force of arms and threat of imminent slaughter resulted in another massacre on 29th of October 1956 in the village of Kfar Qasim. Soldiers went door-to-door spraying homes with gunfire. 49 residents were massacred in under an hour, men, women and children gunned down in cold blood. The violence was calculated, intended to stoke terror and make the Palestinians flee for their lives. According to Palestinian historians, the massacre of Kfar Qasim mirrored the typical Israeli blueprint of terrorizing Palestinians into fleeing. In his book, Atlas of Palestine, 1917-1966, Dr. Salman Abu Sitta lists at least 232 places where atrocities, massacres, destruction, plunder and looting were carried out by the Zionist military forces between 1947 and 1956. Almost every one of 30 military operations were accompanied by one or two massacres of civilians. There were at least 77 reported massacres. Decades of Israeli occupation birthed countless atrocities against Palestinians, including horrors beyond their borders. In 1982, the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon became a brutal killing field. The militia unleashed into the camps under Israeli protection went on a 38-hour rampage. They slaughtered over 3,000 Palestinian civilians in cold blood. Rape, mutilation and torture preceded endless executions. Parents saw their children die before facing the same fate. Israel denied any direct blame, but its fingerprints were all over the place. They lit up the camps at night to aid the killers. They prevented desperate Palestinian victims from fleeing the refugee camps. United Nations resolutions declared Israel complicit in this act of genocide. The then Israeli War Minister Ariel Sharon found personally responsible for enabling the bloodbath, but he faced no real consequences. The victims of the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps saw no justice. It was one of the countless episodes of Israeli leaders incubating anti-Palestinian violence with impunity. Israel's violence against Palestinians extends far beyond isolated massacres. Thousands have been killed over decades to maintain Israel's illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories. Past Gaza assaults bear names now synonymous with death. Operation Cast Lead in 2008-2009 left 1,400 Palestinians dead. Operation Protective Edge in 2014 killed 2,251 Palestinians. These attacks came on the heels of countless other operations, each leaving hundreds of people dead and thousands more wounded. The onslaught did not cease. During the 2019 Great March of Return, Israeli snipers gunned down 267 unarmed Palestinian protesters. Over 30,000 more suffered critical injuries. Children and medical staff were not spared. Israel's desperate myths may multiply, but the blood-drenched reality remains. The propaganda will not whisk away the war crimes, nor inoculate Israel from accountability.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting topic and examining a very significant question. That is a question which has intrigued thinkers from times immemorial. And the question is related to a topic which is very closely connected with our lives, and that is the nature of death. What is the nature of death? First of all, death is a topic that has been alluded to in many places in the Holy Quran. For example, in one place in the Holy Quran, we read the following, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, He who created death and life, that he may test you to see which of you is best in conduct, and he is the Almighty, the All-Forgiving. So In this verse of the Holy Quran, we read that, you know, death is something that God Almighty has, you know, has designated in order to attest us and examine whether we are good or bad. Death is also something which is certain, meaning it's definite and there's no escaping it. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read, "Every soul shall taste of death, and you will indeed be paid your full rewards on the day of resurrection. Whoever is delivered from the fire and admitted to paradise has certainly succeeded. The life of this world is nothing but the wares of delusion." But the question that we want to ask today is with respect to the nature of death and how can we interpret it or how will it be? Fortunately, we have many hadiths which illuminate and elucidate the nature of death. And when we examine these hadiths, we find that death can vary from person to person. For a group of people, such as the believers, it can be something very painful. But for another group of people, it can be something very pleasant. Why is this so? Let's look at the hadith and let's examine what it says therein. In a beautiful hadith from Imam Al-Qadim alayhi salam, read that he once visited a person who was immersed in the pangs of death. When he saw this person in such pain, he said, "Death is the purifier, which purifies the believers from their sins. So it is the last pain when they are struck with. So it is the last pain that they are struck with as atonement for their last wrongdoing left in them." So if you see a believer, a very good person who is in a lot of pain at the time of death, and, you know, this raises the question that why would Allah put this good person in such pain at this time? The answer to this is, according to this hadith, is that God Almighty, this is a way of purifying a person, a believer, from his sins that he might have committed in this world, so that he can enter the hereafter in a pleasant state. In continuation, the Imam says, "For the infidels, death strips them of their good deeds. So it is the last pleasure or leisure they will ever experience, and it will be the last reward of a good deed for them." In the sense that it allows their death to be pleasant as a reward for their good deeds, so that in the hereafter they do not have any recompense for them. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at death and its nature in the light of the Quran and Hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms, I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you, you of my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since some of thee inside my aching heart, some of thee inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel presses ahead with its deadliest strikes on the Gaza Strip, raising the death toll of Palestinians to more than 8,000, most of them women and children. People on Radio Spain, France, Pakistan, and other